figures in the Mark Foley congressional page scandal are testifying before the House Ethics Committee today. House Majority Leader John Boehner and former House Clerk Jeff Trandall, who ran the page program, are scheduled to appear before the panel investigating whether lawmakers or congressional staffers suppressed or ignored complaints about Foley's inappropriate emails to male House pages. Meanwhile, the Sarasota Herald Tribune in Florida today quotes a Catholic priest who describes an intimate two-year relationship he had with Foley when Foley was a teenage altar boy living in Lake Worth, Florida. Foley resigned from his seat in Congress September 29th and later said he had been abused by a Catholic priest. He's since named that priest to state prosecutors, but today's news is the first public notice. Matthew Doig is an investigative reporter for the Sarasota Herald Tribune. He joins us from Sarasota. Matthew, first tell us, who is this priest?
Well, his name is Father Anthony Merchicha. He's a retired Archdiocese of Miami priest who is currently living in Gozo, which is an island off Malta.
He's a priest there?
Yes, he's an active priest, according to the Gozo Diocese website.
What did he say to you about his relationship with Mark Foley when Mark was a teen?
As their relationship developed, he saw it as innocent at the time, but that it may be viewed as inappropriate in hindsight. They would go on trips together. There was occasions where they were naked in front of each other on these overnight trips. There were naked encounters in a sauna on two occasions. And they had general discussions about sex that he said were definitely, in hindsight, inappropriate.
Well, and not only that, he says that there was an incident in which he was taking tranquilizers and alcohol and doesn't remember his behavior except to remember that he might have gone too far.
He said that he was on tranquilizers at the time because he was going through a nervous breakdown, and then he also drank alcohol, and that on one occasion there was a time where he had too much of both the tranquilizers and the alcohol, and that something that went way beyond the line, beyond even the naked back massages and the skinny dipping.
He's an older gentleman. He's in his 70s now.
Right.
Did he, though, sound somewhat deluded about, you know, whether or not this was appropriate even at the time?
Well, he seemed very confused about why Mark Foley was coming forward with this now.
Yeah, he was saying things to you like, I don't know why he wants to ruin me.
You know, he was adamant about this being a one-time encounter, not only with Mark Foley, but with anybody.
Are you convinced this is the priest that Mark Foley was talking about when he said he was abused? Because you also quote a childhood friend of Foley's who said he thought it was another priest in their parish who tried to open that boy's pant fly. So are you convinced this is the one and the only one?
I'd be lying if I said I knew it was the only one. I mean, Mark Foley's only said there was one. And we are convinced it is this person, not only because of the source close to the family, but because Father Tony himself, and then I believe this morning CNN confirmed the state attorney's office, which apparently was the only agency that had the name beyond Foley's lawyer and us, confirmed that that, in fact, was the name of the person.
What has the Catholic Church in Florida told you about this? First of all, were they aware prior to today, you know, prior to your reporting, of the name of this priest in connection to Mark Foley? And have there been any other allegations outside of the Mark Foley charge against this priest?
No, as far as we know, this was the first time that they learned their name, and as far as we know, this is the only allegation that's ever been leveled against this priest.
Matthew Doig, what have people in your area been saying about Mark Foley prior to this news? And are you getting any sense, I mean, it's early on, but are you getting any sense of perhaps a change in attitude towards him because, in fact, this father has said that he might have had, in hindsight, inappropriate behavior with Mark Foley?
There was a lot of speculation about whether Mark Foley was inventing this in order to create some sort of sympathy, and or whether it was part of his therapy that he kind of had to unburden himself of this. But whether it generates sympathy for him, I have no idea.
Matthew Doig, investigative reporter at the Sarasota Herald Tribune. He and fellow reporter Maurice Tamman today broke the story naming the priest who says he had what could be called an inappropriate relationship with former Congressman Mark Foley when Foley was an altar boy. Matthew, thanks for speaking with us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Well, tomorrow, Russian President Vladimir Putin will meet in Finland with EU leaders, and it's expected that he will get an earful about human rights and freedom of expression, including a call for an independent investigation into the death of a crusading Russian journalist. After the murder earlier this month of investigative journalist Anna Politkovskaya, Putin said the shooting damaged Russia's image. Some say it was already damaged. Politkovskaya was the 13th Russian journalist to be killed since 2000, leading media watchdog groups to label Russia one of the world's deadliest countries for journalists. The head of the Russian Union of Journalists says there simply is no freedom of expression in Russia. Well, joining us for his unique view is Evgeny Kiselov. He's been called the Walter Cronkite of Russia. After communism fell, he ran two of Russia's biggest television stations until they were taken over by Russian energy companies connected to the Putin government. He's now the host of a current affairs program on the leading radio station in Moscow and a newspaper columnist, and he joins us here in the studio. Welcome, Evgeny. May I call you Evgeny?
Of course, you're welcome.
I want to ask you, first of all, about Politkovskaya, a critic of the government policy. We've been hearing that in the last couple of weeks, especially of the war in Chechnya. What was your opinion of her?
I think she was a very brave woman. And she was totally dedicated to the cause, of defending human rights, writing about human rights abuse in Chechnya, trying to prove that very often highly placed government officials were to blame for that. Not only some local thugs or field commanders, but highly placed local officials. And you know what? You were quoting our president, Mr. Putin, saying that the murder of Anna Politkovskaya damaged Russian image abroad.
You had some pretty strong words to say after he said that.
Look, he actually said that her murder damaged Russia more than her articles. And every person understood this correctly. President considered that Politkovskaya's articles were damaging Russia. That's how our president thinks about free press. That was absolutely shocking and disgusting.
Well, you mentioned Mr. Putin's comments. We should say that 15 years after the fall of communism, unsolved contract killings are not unusual. In the past month, an oil company engineer and two prominent bankers were also killed. And some say that these killings are scarier than some others because they appear to many to be battles between business and the state. So with that in mind, do you have any sense, or do Russians have any feeling that the government might have somehow been involved in your colleague's killing?
Well, I cannot say that such presumptions are groundless. Look, Politkovskaya was about to publish a big article about how local government, loyal to President Putin, is involved in torture and human rights abuse. And when such a critic is being killed, well, of course, any kind of suspicions, because no one was more interested in her death than those who were criticized by her. And it's an important point that I am trying to draw your attention to. Killed not because they wanted to prevent her from publishing those articles. Unfortunately, most revealing articles published by many journalists in Russia produce no effect on the government policy. They are just ignored. Unfortunately, that's how it looks now in Moscow.
But because they're not read by many people.
It was kind of a revenge. It was a vendetta for her previous publications and a lesson to be taught by other journalists. Don't behave like her.
This is a very strong feeling. Can you express that in your columns? Can you say that on the radio?
Yes, I can.
Have you?
Yes, I did.
Do you think your words, though, have an impact? And I ask you because, as you well know, you know better than anybody, media watchdog groups say that under Putin, Russian television stations have become mouthpieces for the government, including the one that you used to work at, that he eased the way for it to be taken over by the state-owned gas company. And critical voices such as yours may be heard on the internet, they may be heard in some newspapers, but newspapers, we understand the best newspaper reaches 100,000 people as opposed to, you know, there's 143 million in Russia. Radio stations as well, they're just smaller in reach. And so do you think that the government understands that really it doesn't pose as much of a threat?
Well, of course, government understands that. But it's not because of low circulation of the opposition papers or small audiences of opposition-minded radio stations like the Echo of Moscow, for which I work from time to time. It's because, unfortunately, the public mood in Russia now is such that freedom of the press and other human freedoms are, so to say, not part of the basic consumer basket.
Not part of the basic consumer basket. Elaborate on that, because I'm wondering if it has to do with a comment I read by, is it Nikolai Zvanidze? He's a presenter on one of the stations, and he says...
Zvanidze. Nikolai Zvanidze, yes.
Yeah. He says the Russian people don't want alternatives. Is that what you mean by not part of the consumer basket?
I mean that people are caring about... different things and values rather than they were caring 10 or 15 years ago. Unfortunately, laying the foundation for today's prosperity was very painful
for
the population.
But the population
doesn't care about that.
Evgeny Kisilov, you have been very outspoken here. You've said you don't censor yourself when speaking or writing in Russia.
Well, I sometimes,
do you?
Pace myself, you know. You always have to measure up your emotions with reality.
That reminds me, we began by speaking about your former colleague, investigative journalist Anna Politkovskaya. And you were saying that, you know, she was very... impassioned, and you told us that she had said of you that maybe you were too soft on the government.
We never discussed it with her. We were never close, you know.
I guess I'm saying, though, that perhaps you are alive and sitting here and talking, and I'm wondering if there's a certain survival technique that a reporter, a journalist in Russia has to incorporate, or do you think that's too strong?
No, I think you are a little bit exaggerating.
Yeah,
I think that any one of us could be chosen as a target of a provocation like that. Mm. It was a lesson to all of us, and some will get frightened, and some will not. I am not frightened.
Evgeny Kisilov, he hosts a program on Moscow's leading radio station. In a moment, we'll come back and we'll take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to know, is the Cold War heating up again? And maybe what American media can learn from Russian journalists about covering an unpopular war? Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. With Evgeny Kisilov, he's been called the Walter Cronkite of Russia. After communism fell, he ran two of Russia's most popular television stations until they were effectively silenced. He's now the host of a popular radio program in Moscow and an outspoken critic of Russian President Vladimir Putin. Evgeny, Putin is a former KGB man. He's been accused of undermining the media freedoms instituted under former President Boris Yeltsin. But Putin has also said democracy is a top priority in Russia. What do you think? Is Putin interested in turning Russia into a real democracy?
From the very beginning, the first moment I saw Mr. Putin on television, giving his first interview in his new capacity of Russia's premier, I immediately understood that this guy is a truly KGB person. Mm-hmm. I had some experience. I taught at the KGB Academy early in my youth. I'm a Persian language specialist by education, so I was teaching Persian at the KGB Academy in Moscow. And he was exactly like the guys I was giving lessons to, just a living copy of them. And I never believed that Mr. Putin is a true Democrat, contrary to the beliefs of some of the G8 leaders.
I want to ask you some foreign policy questions. Russian-U.S. relations, as you know, had a low point a while back when Vice President Dick Cheney accused President Putin of using the energy resources to blackmail Europe. The U.S. and Russia were at odds over getting tough with Iran, you know, over its nuclear program. Now there's conversation because of North Korea, so perhaps Russia and the U.S. are working a little closer on that. But some Russian media pundits we've read have speculated that there's a sort of a return of the Cold War. What's your thought?
Well, I think that the Cold War can return only if both sides that participated in the last Cold War would be willing to do that. By the way, I was present at that conference in Vilnius where Mr. Cheney delivered his famous speech that was so criticized in Russia as an attempt to declare a new Cold War on our country. May I say that, well, I'm not an admirer of this Republican administration, and I'm not an admirer of Mr. Cheney. And more than that, I think that this administration and its foreign policy is largely responsible for what is happening in Russia today.
How so?
When George Bush became new American president, they decided after the first meeting with Vladimir Putin that Russia's domestic politics and Russian developments at home will never again be an issue in Russian-American relationship. Because in the past, when something undemocratic, anti-liberal happened in Moscow or anywhere in Russia, America always decisively raised her voice against those steps. I know of many examples when American interference helped Russia stay the course of democracy.
Did you expect the U.S. to step in, for instance, when Vladimir Putin, or through Vladimir Putin, the state-run gas company took over your television station, NTV? Did you expect to hear more of an outcry from the U.S.?
Yes. Yeah. Yes. I think the U.S. was too soft on that particular issue.
Right. One last question. You say you spent a couple of hours watching American television, and I'm just wondering, one of the criticisms of Russian television is that the conflict in Chechnya is not rarely covered, and if it is, it's covered from the perspective of the Russian military. This is on television. What did you think after watching a couple of hours? That may not have been enough to give you a sense, but what do you think about the way the U.S. press covers the war in Iraq?
Good question. I will have to watch and see. And I won't be surprised that if the American television, well, American television, as far as I know, is quite a conservative media and quite loyal to the government as opposed to printed media or the media that exists in the internet. I won't be surprised that they're really pacing themselves and trying not to overcome a certain red line.
Yeah. I'm just curious, what did you watch on TV here?
Well, I was mostly interested in how they cover the forthcoming election.
So politics.
Probably I don't pay a lot of attention to the coverage of hostilities in Iraq, but, well, it reminds me of a Russian operation in Afghanistan. Soviet troops were in Afghanistan in late 70s, early 80s. At that time, Russian government wanted, the then Soviet government wanted to export communism, well, let's say, export socialist system to the neighbor in Afghanistan. And this experiment unfortunately failed. You can't export socialism to a country which is still living in the Middle Ages. And I think American attempt to export democracy to Iraq, well, will be, well, I wish that they succeed. But I have many reservations against the methods. That brings me to the third that probably Russia is also not so very ripe to become a true democracy. And read between the lines of our constitution, and you will very soon understand that presidential powers are enormous, and they are, for example, much bigger than the presidential powers of the American president. Our political system is reminiscent of a monarchy.
Evgeny Kisilov, again, a Russian journalist who is prominent in Russia, even though he ran two television stations there and energy companies connected to the government took them over. He now writes political commentary and hosts a current affairs program on Echo of Moscow, the leading radio station in the Russian capital. And it is in the U.S., speaking at colleges and universities here on the East Coast. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from Ever since the popular internet meeting place for teens, MySpace, went online, people have worried that kids could be targeted by sex offenders. MySpace says they do protect children by allowing minors to block their online profiles. But in congressional testimony, MySpace officials said they don't have the resources to track known sex offenders who may be using their website. Well, a journalist with a background in computer programming has proven them wrong. Kevin Paulson, senior editor at Wired News, wrote a computer program that cross-referenced MySpace's 1 million-plus profiles with the Department of Justice's National Sex Offender Registry. His results, 744 registered sex offenders also registered as MySpace users. Kevin Paulson joins us now from his office in San Francisco. Kevin, how'd you get started doing this?
You know, I actually began this project before MySpace gave this congressional testimony where they said that this couldn't be done using the existing registry. And it turns out that the Department of Justice's National Sex Offender Registry interfaces to all of these state registries around the country and presents some of the data in a very consistent and easily usable format, specifically the names and the zip codes. MySpace allows you to search for users based on that exact information, so it was a natural match.
And as you went further and you browsed the MySpace profiles of the registered sex offenders who were on MySpace, did you start to see things that raised red flags?
There were some sex offenders who were relatively fresh out of prison who had established a presence on MySpace. One of them had served a substantial prison term for molesting an underage child and set his MySpace motto to love knows not age. There was another one who just recently got out of prison who was on MySpace within 2 months. The most disturbing one was a sexual predator on Long Island in Suffolk County who served a 9-year term for molesting two boys, one 9 and one 11. And about a year after getting out of prison, he was on MySpace, and I found that he was openly soliciting underage guys.
In fact, you went to the police with what you found. What happened then?
Yeah, I contacted the Suffolk County police. They opened an investigation and posed as a 14-year-old boy, chatted him up, and talked to him online for several months. By the end of it all, he was proposing to meet this fake 14-year-old boy at one of several locations, a campsite, a movie theater. They wound up arresting him early this month, and they've charged him with attempted child endangerment.
And we should say that when they arrested him, he was not going to meet this fake 14-year-old. He was driving, though, with two of his five children?
That is correct. They did not succeed in getting him to actually go out to a meeting. They think that had they continued at it, that might have happened.
And what did he say about, you know, what he was doing online?
According to the police, he told them that he had not met with any of the kids. I saw online that he, at one point, had plans to meet with a 14-year-old in Virginia. The plans fell through when the 14-year-old's field trip to an amusement park had been canceled at the last minute. In this case, it turned out because of a recent New York appellate court decision, they could not charge him with a felony. It's sort of a loophole in the law that will probably be fixed or changed shortly. As it is now, he can only be charged with a misdemeanor, so he can serve a maximum of 90 days on that charge.
Well, let's talk about the law, because we understand from your reporting that when this fellow was pulled over by the police, he said, you know, it was just an online thing. I didn't go any further than that. Where is the law on that?
The laws vary from state to state, but I believe in some states, if not most of them, it is a felony to solicit somebody that you know to be underage for sex. This was sort of an unusual decision by the appellate court interpreting the language of a particular New York law.
What can MySpace do, do you think? I mean, because they can't yet ban sex offenders from the site outright. MySpace chief security officer says they're waiting for new laws that would make it easier for them to do that and lobbying Congress for legislation that would require sex offenders to register their email addresses to a central database.
This is a case where the perfect is the enemy of the good enough. You can say we can't do anything until we get legislation that will make this really easy to do, but the fact is the existing registry, as I've now seen and demonstrated, is good enough to do a lot of it. This is something that I worked on part-time for several months in order to manually go through and make the definite matches. But it's something that MySpace is in a unique position to be able to do much more effectively themselves. They have access to private data that I didn't have. At one point, enhanced privacy measures of the site allowed adults to start protecting their profiles so that you couldn't see much about them, and that made it much harder for me to go through and find potential matches. That wouldn't be a problem for MySpace. I think I would agree with people that say that there are other places just as, if not more, dangerous than MySpace. In general, I think that the site is a good thing for kids, but it's privately run, and you have to expect that when you have a company that's making money by the number of kids that are using it, the number of teenagers, they have an obligation to make the space as safe as they can, the same way that the mall security guard doesn't look the other way if he sees a child molester pull a kid into the photo booth.
What has MySpace said to you about what it might do given what you've done?
They told me they're lobbying for legislation to get email addresses in the sex offender registry.
Well, meantime, you mentioned that you thought MySpace was actually good for kids, and part of that thinking came from a conversation you had with a kid who was in conversation, virtual conversation, with this sex offender. What did he say when you told him who it was he'd been talking to?
He professed surprise at learning that Lou Brano was a convicted child molester. Teenagers have an idea of a sex offender that's either very abstract or perhaps cartoonish. They think of somebody in the trench coat, and they don't make this connection. They don't perhaps understand that if a 39-year-old man expresses a sexual interest in a 14- or 16-year-old teenager, that that's not healthy.
And you also suggested to him to be more careful about the friends he added, but what's happened?
I urged him to be more careful about the friends that he accepts onto his friends list. He has nearly 4,000 of them last time I checked. And to make his profile private, which is an option that MySpace makes available so that strangers can't learn everything about you just by reading what you've posted on your MySpace profile. He hasn't done that. This is a 14-year-old boy in Virginia who's gay. And he finds a lot of support online that he probably isn't getting in his local community, in his local school. At one point, he posts an anecdote about being picked on by some homophobic, he says, bullies at his school. And when he posts that on his MySpace profile, he's inundated with support from friends. I could see how that would just be an incredibly valuable thing for somebody like that. And it would be a shame if anything that we did in reaction to these incidents of MySpace predation wound up robbing kids of access to this kind of support system.
Kevin Poulsen, one very last question briefly. You have another life as a hacker. You served some time in prison for hacking into radio call-in contests and breaking into phone company systems. You served 5 years for computer and wire fraud.
Well, my hacking ended when the 80s ended. I've spent most of the last 10 years as a professional journalist, so most of what I do is investigative reporting. It was a different time, and I was a different person.
Kevin Poulsen, senior editor at Wired News, has developed a computer code that found close to 750 registered sex offenders using the MySpace social networking website used by so many teenagers. Kevin, thanks for speaking with us.
Yeah, no problem.
And a better use of his skills. Still to come, Joseph Cross on playing author Augustin Burroughs in the new film Running with Scissors. You're listening to Here and Now. It's winner take all tonight at Shea Stadium in New York as the Mets take on the St. Louis Cardinals in Game 7 of the National League Championship Series. The Mets have history on their side. The past 11 home teams that have won Game 6 of a championship or World Series game have gone on to win Game 7. Huh, we're very aware of that. Gee, isn't this the month, the anniversary of the Red Sox boggle that allowed the Mets to beat the Sox at their home game, Game 6 in 1986? But I digress. Looking forward, we called in Bill Littlefield of NPR's Only a Game for a preview of tonight's game. Bill, this hasn't been an easy series for the Mets. What happened?
Well, for one thing, they lost half their pitching staff before the postseason even began. And so last night, they trotted out a rookie named John Main. Not exactly a household name, but he was good enough. And he won six games during the regular season. And now he's a postseason hero. And in Game 7, the most important game of the season so far, they'll be pitching Oliver Perez, who won a total of three games during the regular season.
All right, then.
And is just been rejected by teams much worse than the Mets in the past. So who knows? I mean, it's a great ride.
Well, that's why they were expected to sail through, but that actually makes it more fun to watch. You know,
seventh games.
Yeah,
are what
they're
we
the
live
best.
For. That's
the
what
best.
It's about.
Well, whoever wins tonight's game goes on to play the Detroit Tigers Saturday in the World Series. Now, they've been taking a leisurely week off, waiting for the National League to wrap up. Is that going to help or hurt?
Well, speaking as we were of pitching, it certainly should help Kenny Rogers of the Tigers. He's over 40 years old, and I can't imagine he's complaining about having some extra rest. The other Tigers pitchers are kids. They're in their early 20s, and so they'll be fine. Seriously, it's always a question. Sometimes the time off really helps, and people get healthy, and they play better. And sometimes the time off tends to make them a little rusty, and we won't know that until the World Series begins.
Before we let you go, quick mention, Homeland Security alerted NFL authorities of threats of dirty bombs being set off at seven football stadiums this week, and officials have said that threat is not credible. Mm-hmm. But what's the buzz? I mean, people going to stay away from the games? Or?
I wouldn't imagine anybody would stay away from the game, Robin. If this administration hasn't cranked up the fear alert and changed the colors and everything else, then by golly, there's nothing there.
Bill Littlefield, host of NPR's Only a Game. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Well, we want to take just a few minutes now to air some of your thoughts. We recently reported on the invisible fence being built along parts of the U.S. border with Mexico. That fence would use radar, sensors, and cameras to detect illegal immigrants. Well, Linda Ray, who's with the Tucson Samaritans, a rescue group, wrote, she says, the reality is, even if the equipment works to identify the location of migrants, the apprehension will be the place things break down. A pursuing agent may need to drive and walk for hours, by which time the migrants will be long gone, and helicopters? Migrants scatter when they see a helicopter. Many will be lost. Some will die. Regardless of how anyone feels about the death penalty, there's no immigration violation that calls for it. And in any case, our legal system prohibits cruel and unusual punishment, of which death by exposure and thirst are the highest sort. The trouble with all the fence proposals is the same. We're trying to solve a security problem by exacerbating a moral one. Well, after our look at how the Bush administration has increasingly doled out foreign aid guided by faith-based organizations, Jane Hunt of Concord, New Hampshire wrote us, as a Christian, I'm grieved to hear that secular AIDS organizations working with prostitutes lost funding because of objections from evangelical groups. Some U.S. Christians have apparently forgotten that prostitutes figured prominently among those with whom and through whom Christ worked. And finally, after we spoke with Donald Craybill, an expert on Amish life, to try to understand that community in the wake of that terrible schoolhouse shooting, we heard from Brenda Reel of East Fallowfield, Pennsylvania. She writes, thank you. My parents grew up Amish, and many of my relatives still are Amish. I have only one correction. While the focus of the preachers during the funerals is God, they generally do speak briefly about the deceased, mostly talking about their good Amish qualities. Well, we appreciate your thoughts on any story. You can write us at here-now.org or call 617-358-0397. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Augustine Burroughs' memoir, Running with Scissors, a smash bestseller in hardcover, is now number one in paperback and on its way to the big screen. The new film of the same title is pretty true to the book. It tells how, after his parents' alcohol-fueled divorce, Augustine's mother gave him away to her controversial psychiatrist, plunging the then preteen into a world even more troubling than the one he left. In this scene, Dr. Finch takes Augustine to task for cutting school.
I know you stand till homeroom when they do attendance and then you skip out. I know when you've been naughty.
What are you, Santa Claus?
If by that you're asking, am I the great patriarch, the father giver, who fulfills wishes and challenges dreams and brings merriment to those who are suffering? Well then, yes, Augustine, I am Santa Claus.
One of the tamer scenes from Running with Scissors, Augustine Burroughs says the real-life doctor had inappropriate sexual relationships with his patients and encouraged Augustine to have one as well with a 34-year-old psychotic man living in a shed in the backyard. That's what Augustine Burroughs says. The real-life doctor's family has filed suit against him and his book publisher, saying many of the incidents never happened. Well, this week it was announced that the family reached an undisclosed settlement with the film studio, clearing the way for the movie's release. It stars Annette Bening as Augustine's desperately needy and mentally unwell mother, Brian Cox as the psychiatrist, and newcomer Joseph Cross as Augustine himself. This week we sat down with Joseph Cross, who at the tender age of 20 is taking on a fairly complex and foreign role.
My parents have been married happily for 28 years. I have four siblings who are all younger than me, and we're all very close, and we live in a house together in Westchester. I mean, I just got my own place, actually, but I'm very close to them, and I stay there a lot.
And so suddenly you're thrust into the world of Augustine Burroughs and Running with Scissors. What was that like for you?
It was very different. I mean, my mom wouldn't let me, you know, cross streets by myself, it feels like, until I was 17, let alone live in a house with a bunch of crazy people and have a relationship with a 34-year-old guy. So it was challenging to figure that out.
I'm wondering, too, if half the time I watched you on the screen with this look of shock on your face, that maybe, not to take away from your acting skills, but at least in some moments, that wasn't acting.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the best thing for an actor is to be given something that actually does it for you, you know, because it's the most authentic. You'll never be able to recreate that.
Would you like to try some?
No. Thanks.
Why does everybody make such a fuss? It's just a little kibble.
That stuff's not clean. It's for dogs.
Well, I guess you're afraid to try new things, Augustine. Sad.
Can you just tick off some of the things the characters do? I'm thinking of the moment when one of the daughters of the doctor thinks telepathically that her cat needs to die, so she holds him under a container until he does die.
Yeah, that's Hope, Gwyneth Paltrow's character, that kills her cat.
And we're laughing, but I was very disturbing.
It is disturbing. What's so funny about that is that you see an image of the dead cat, and at this point you've seen the worst things in that movie, but you see the dead cat, and everyone in the theater goes, "Aww!" And it's like, I mean, I've been giving up to my psychiatrist by my crazy parents. You didn't moan for me, damn it.
What are some of the others?
I mean, Augustine, Natalie, Evan Rachel Wood's character, Natalie, take down the ceiling, because there's sort of this underlying tone of oppression in the movie, and so the ceiling is crushing them, they say, and so they want to make a skylight, and they do, which is crazy. They break through the ceiling with objects that they've found in the kitchen to make a skylight, and then when Finch sees it, he says that he thinks it brings a much added sense of humor to the kitchen.
Dr. Finch at one point wakes the entire household to come look at his bowel movement because he believes it's delivering a message.
It coils in the toilet, and the tip is protruding from the water, and he believes that that is a direct sign from God that things are looking up because it's pointing upward towards the heavens. Standard stuff, really.
What is it?
It's an electroshock therapy machine. My dad used to use it on patients all the time. Until the police came. Come on, it'll be a wicked blast. Help me move it.
At the end of the film, there's a picture of you and Augustine side by side. It's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, it's a fun. It's a fun picture.
Well, you look. You do look a little alike.
We do totally look alike. Absolutely.
Did he help you with the role? Did he tell you things to help you, you know, play him?
The main thing that Augustine helped me with was finding the comedy in it, because I didn't understand for the life of me. I couldn't understand for the life of me how somebody would have such a positive attitude towards this and would see it as something that was comical. So to me, I didn't get that, and I couldn't really bring that to the character. But when I met with Augustine, what he told me was the way that he survived it was finding the comedy in it.
You also have to find compassion in places where people might not. I'm thinking of the relationship that Augustine Burroughs describes in real life that he had with a 30-something seemingly psychotic pedophile who was living in the shed in the back of the doctor's house, who had a sexual relationship with Augustine when he was 13.
Yeah, you know, that was strange for me. I never expected my first love scene on screen to be with a 34-year-old man. But people say to me, you know, were you afraid of playing a gay character? And I have a couple things to say about that. First of all, I was more scared to play a real-life person than I was to play a gay character. Also, I think it's interesting.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, you know.
Oh, Augustine.
Augustine, yeah. You know, and he's alive, and he has such a close following, and his fans are so loyal. And his book did so well that I wanted to do all that justice, and that was really daunting. Also, we live in a very heteronormative world, and we expect our gay characters to be, you know, shopping with the girls and doing makeup and stuff like that. And I think that here you get to see, for one of the first times, a character that's not defined by his sexuality. You know, he's gay, but it's not a defining factor. It's almost as if it's an afternote.
Well, you know, it's funny. I wasn't even asking about that. It was more about a young person trying to take care of an older person.
Yeah. That's what's funny is, you know, I think that if you say to somebody, it's a 34-year-old man and a 13-year-old boy, they would immediately villainize Bookman and, you know, think that he was a predator. But it's really Augustine who's the adult in the relationship.
Just want to ask you again, 20-year-old? Yeah. Again, a 20-year-old actor. I just want to ask you who you are working so closely with. Annette Bening, for instance, an incredibly intense performance. What was that like?
That was tremendous for me because Annette is such a strong, talented actress and woman. And, you know, to be able to work with her, I would come on set and all I had to do was look in her eyes and be moved in the direction that my character needed to be moved in. So it makes your life a lot easier.
One last question. You are also, at the same time you're in this film, you're also in Clint Eastwood's Flags of Our Fathers. What's next for you? What's left for you? Well, probably a lot left, but what's next?
Good question. I mean, for me, I just want to be able to keep doing work that's going to stimulate me in this sort of way and really challenge me. And I want to play a character that's very different from both of these characters. But I think that to do that, I really need to wait for that. So I think I'm going to go back and do another semester of college. That's what my plan is right now.
Where would that be?
At Trinity College in Connecticut in Hartford. So I have two semesters in the can. I had to take two off. So I'm stumbling, but I'm on my way.
What, to take acting classes?
No, not to take acting classes. you know, to take classes in psychology and philosophy and those sorts of things, these things that I didn't get to learn in high school and that I don't know now. And also, if I have a son and he tells me I don't want to go to college, I need to be able to say, well, I went and you have to go, so.
Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by.
Actor Joseph Cross, he stars as Augustine Burroughs in the new film Running with Scissors. And by the way, that's Crosby, Stills, and Nash from the soundtrack of the film. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Don't you ever ask them why, if they told you you would cry.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.